deep blue sky and the stars through the open garage door, so it wasn't as scary as she'd thought at first. Besides, Mr. Sellers had told her it would happen, and anyway she was nearly done with her special job. She stepped away from the cloth, held up the little plastic tube, and pushed the button. A spark jumped up. Even though she had been expecting it, it surprised her, and she dropped the plastic thing, which clattered on the garage floor and bounced away somewhere to one side. There was nothing but shadow on the floor, deep and black. She couldn't see anything. Her heart went bump, bump in her chest like a bird was trapped inside her and trying to get out. What if she lost the plastic tube? Then Mr. Sellers would get in trouble. He'd said it was very, very important. And maybe she would get in trouble too. And her mommy and daddy would be so angry. Plus, maybe Mr. Sellers would be put in jail. Christabel got down on her hands and knees to search. Right away, she put her hands on something dry and crackly. She wanted to scream again, but even though she was really afraid of what might be down there, spiders, worms, snakes, more spiders, skeletons like in the spook house, she had to keep looking. She just had to. Mr. Sellers had said to do it when the street lamp went out. He had said! Christabel began to cry. At last, after a very long time, she felt the smooth plastic beneath her fingers. Sniffling, she got to her feet, then felt her way to the back of the car again. She held the thing away from her so it wouldn't be so scary, then pushed the button. The spark jumped and turned into fire. She took the end of the cloth, carefully, just like Mr. Sellers had said, and touched it to the fire. The cloth began to burn. Not a big fire, just a blue edge that smoked. She crammed her gloves into the opening to keep the license plate from swinging shut, then stretched the burning end of the cloth as far from the car as it would go before dropping it onto the floor. She walked out of the garage quickly, saying the last part of the rhyme to herself, partly to make sure she remembered, partly because she was really scared. Outside, she pushed the button on the wall, and the garage door hissed down. Now, with almost everything done, Christabel turned and ran up Redland as fast as she could. All the houses were dark, but now all the street lamps were dark too, so she ran with only the light of the stars to show her the way. As she turned the corner and hurried down Stillwell, she threw the plastic flame maker into some bushes. Then, when she reached her own front lawn, all the street lamps suddenly started to shine again. She hurried to her front door. Christabel had forgotten about the alarm. When she pushed the door open, speakers all over the house began to buzz, startling her so much she almost wet her pants. Over the horrible noise, she heard her father begin to shout. Terrified, she ran as fast as she could and got through her bedroom door just before the door to her parents' room banged open. She threw off her coat and shoes and clothes, praying that they wouldn't come in. She had just got her jammies on when her mother hurried in. "Christabel, are you okay? Don't be scared. It's the door alarm, but I think it went off by accident."
"It's some kind of power outage, I think," her father shouted from down the hall. "The wall screens are all off, and my watch is almost an hour different than the kitchen clock. Must have triggered the alarm when it came back on."
Christabel had just been tucked back in bed by her mother and was scrunching down beneath the covers, feeling her heart begin to slow, when the flame at last reached the gas tank in Mr. Sellers' Cadillac. It made a noise like God himself clapping his hands together, rattling windows for miles, and waking up almost everyone on the base. Christabel screamed. Her mother came back into the bedroom, and this time sat beside her in the dark, rubbing her neck and telling her it was all right. It was a gas line or something. It was a long way away. Christabel clung to her mother's stomach, feeling like she was so full of secrets that she might blow up too. Light flickered in the treetops outside as the fire trucks hurried past, going,
"Wee-aw, wee-aw, wee-aw."
"Hey, Lando Garner, you got Swordhead House,"
Zuni commented. Tiny yellow monkeys were busily rearranging the decor of Orlando's cot. Two of them were adding an exaggerated handlebar mustache to the severed head of the Black Elf Prince, and half a dozen others seemed to have changed the body of the Worm of Morrison Keep into a transparent chute. As Orlando watched, one little banana-colored simian was sliding on its belly through the innards of Thargor's prize beast.
"Swordhead? Oh, yeah. I used to spend a lot of time in the Middle Country. You know that? Boring,"
pronounced Zuni.
"Kill monster, find jewel, earn bonus points. Wibble-wobble-wobble."
Orlando couldn't really argue.
He turned to watch another pair of monkeys altering the historical pictures of the Karagorum tapestry into a procession of cartoon snails having sex. He scowled. It wasn't so much the exuberant vandalism that bothered him, he had gotten pretty sick of the old decor, as the seemingly effortless way the wicked tribe had penetrated his protected programming. It would have taken a team of engineers from some place like Indigo a whole afternoon to manage what these little lunatics had done in minutes. He suddenly understood how his parents must have felt when he tried to explain the things he did on the net. Beezel appeared from a hole in the ceiling and was instantly swarmed by mini-apes.
"If you don't get these things off of me," the agent warned, "I'm gonna dress 'em."
"Be my guest. I'd like to see you manage it." Beezel knotted his legs tight to protect them from marauding monkeys.
"Fredericks is requesting permission to enter."
Orlando felt something grow warmer inside him. "Yeah, sure. Let him in." He would have to get this straightened out in his mind, it seemed. So if Fredericks wanted to be treated like a guy, then she was a guy. Just like old times. Sort of. Fredericks popped in and was immediately set upon by flying yellow creatures. As he waved his hands reflexively to clear his field of vision, he could have made them transparent if he had thought about it, since he knew the capacities of Orlando's cod almost as well as its creator did. Orlando looked him over. Fredericks' sim seemed a little less spectacularly muscle-bound than usual. Maybe after hearing about Orlando's disease, he thought that looking so healthy might be offensive.
"Los monos volandos!"
shouted one of the tribe, buzzing Frederick's face.
"We supremo Big Daddy Culture Club! Happy Flappy Trails!"
"Jesus, Orlando, this is fun,"
grumped Fredericks as he flicked away a tiny ape who had been swinging from his simulated earlobe.
"I'm utterly glad I didn't miss this."
"Yeah, I'm glad you didn't miss it, too." A moment of awkward silence, silence except for the chattering and aimless noise-making of the tribe, ended when Orlando clapped his hands. The yellow clouds split apart into simian particles, which settled down on various virtual surfaces. "I wanted to ask you guys for a favor." He tried to look like the kind of person a flock of feral children should want to help. "I need help really badly."
"You cred us?"
squealed some of the monkeys.
"Spree buy? Toys and gear?"
But Kaspar, Orlando was beginning to recognize a few of their voices, shushed them.
"What favor you need?"
"I'm trying to find somebody. The name is Melchior, and it's something to do with Treehouse. He or she, or maybe it's more than one person, did some software work, some gear, for a red griffin in the Middle Country sim world."
"Melchior?"
said Zuni, rising to hover in the air like a particularly homely little fairy.
"Easy! Dog, dog, dog! And doggy friends!"
said another monkey. "Wait a minute. What do you mean?"
"This is like talking to breakfast cereal," said Fredericks. "Give it up, Orlando.
Hang on. Zuni, is dog a person?" The tiny ape spun.
"No, no, not person. Old. Million years."
Kaspar shushed some of the younger tribesfolk again.
"He is old person. We call him dog. He lives in Cobweb Corner. Older than rocks,"
shouted one of the monkeys.
"Older than Uncle Jingle,"
giggled another.
"Oh, oh, old."
Tortuously, Orlando managed to glean the information that some old person called something like Blue Dog and Crite, or just Dog, kept an Elcott in Founder's Hill at Treehouse, and along with some other people had once created gear under the name of Melchior.
"Made blast-up button,"
Zuni remembered with pleasure.
"Put it on someone's head. Push it. Boom!"
Orlando hoped that she was talking about something that happened to Sims, not real people. "Can you get us back into Treehouse so we can talk to him?"
"Woof,"
said Zuni.
"Even better. You view he view you. We get him right now,"
Kaspar explained.
"Dog, he love wicked tribe. Always he says just what I need when we visit him for fun games."
The monkeys rose in a sudden yellow cyclone, spun so rapidly they seemed to smear like melting butter, then disappeared. Orlando sat appreciating the silence. His head was beginning to throb, a slight feverish ache. Fredericks rose and glided to the vandalized pyramid of trophies, stopping in front of the black elf prince.
"Dieter Cabo would love this.
Don't blame me. Blame the Tarzan Memorial Art Appreciation Society." Fredericks glided back.
"So you think these micro-scannies are going to help you find something you see in your dreams?"
Orlando, do you ever listen to yourself anymore? I'll follow whatever lead I can get.
Yeah, I noticed.
His friend hesitated.
How are you feeling?
Don't start. I shouldn't have told you anything.
Frederick sighed, but before he could say anything else, one of the cot walls went permeable, and a blizzard of monkeys blew through it.
Come on! One shouted. Come now! Fast, fast, fast!
What is it? Orlando couldn't make any sense out of the tribal din.
What? Found dog!
Zuni's voice purred in his ear. She was hovering just above his left shoulder.
He having big secret, strong line throughout, plus all kinds of colors. Come along. Dog is doing something,
elaborated Kaspar in his other ear.
Something he is trying to hide. Big secret, but no one fools the wicked tribe.
Orlando could not help thinking of a cartoon he had once seen. A man with a devil hovering on one shoulder and an angel on the other, each trying to sway him to its own ends. But what if you had only voices of uncontrolled anarchy in both ears? What are you talking about? What kind of secret? Throughput?
Big hole to somewhere. Come, we hook you up.
Zuni was buzzing at his ear like a bumblebee.
We surprise, dog. Laugh and shriek, laugh and shriek. Wicked tribe, Mayhor, net riding crew, shouted another. Kilohana! Fasten belts!
Slow down! Orlando winced. The fever headache had suddenly gotten fierce, and he did not want to be rushed. But it was too late for any chance of consultation. The monkeys were in full speed ahead mode. Fredericks wavered and disappeared, sucked away to only the wicked tribe knew where. The entire cot began to swirl like several colors of paint poured down the drain.
Damn it, wait a minute!
Orlando shouted. But he was shouting into emptiness and a hiss like an empty signal as they took him, too. Darkness washed over him. He was falling, flying, being pulled apart in several directions. The crackling in his ears grew louder until it roared like the jets of an interplanetary rocket.
Hang on, Lando Garner!
Zuni shouted happily above the noise, somewhere in the darkness. She sounded completely undisturbed. Was this unsettling experience his alone? Or were these mad children simply used to it? The sensation of being pulled grew stronger, as though he were being stretched thin and sucked through a straw. It was like being in some roller-coastering simulation, but surely they must be between simulations. Orlando could hardly think. He seemed to be going faster, ever faster. Then the universe collapsed. Everything stopped, as though something had seized him with a giant hand. He heard distant shrieks, the thin voices of children, but not happy now, faintly, as though from behind a thick door, those children were screeching in terror. Something had them, and it had Orlando, too. The void began to tighten around him, a squeezing fist of nothingness that froze his thoughts and heart. He was helpless, suspended in an arc of slow electricity. The part of him that could still think struggled, but could not free itself. The darkness had weight, and it was crushing him. He could feel himself flattened, pressed, until his last remaining piece of self fluttered helplessly and ever more slowly, like a bird caught beneath a thick blanket.
I don't want to die!
It was a meaningless thought, because there was nothing he could think or do to change what was happening. But it echoed over and over through a mind that was running down. All the death trip simulations in the world could not have prepared him for this.
I don't want to die! I don't want to die! Don't!
What? Astonishingly, the darkness was not infinite. A tiny spark drew him up out of the unspeakable emptiness. He rose toward it helplessly and without volition, as though he were a corpse being dragged from the depths of a river. The spark became a blur of light. After the killing blackness, it seemed an impossible gift. As he floated closer, the light grew, shooting out at all angles, scratching bright marks on the endless slate of night. Lines became a square. The square gained depth and was a cube, which then became something so mundane that for a moment he could not believe it. Floating in the void, becoming larger every moment, was an office, a simple room with desk and chairs. Whether he rose to it or it descended to him, he could not tell, but it spread and surrounded him, and he felt the freezing numbness inside him shift and loosen a little. This is a dream. I'm having a dream, he was certain. He had fallen asleep wearing his jack before and knew the sensation. It's the pneumonia. Must be. A fever dream. But why can't I wake up? The room was something like a medical examining room, but everything in it was made of gray concrete. The vast desk looked like a stone sarcophagus, something from a tomb. Behind the desk sat a man, or at least Orlando thought it was a man. Where the face should be hung a radiant emptiness. "I'm dreaming, aren't I?" he asked. The being behind the desk did not seem to hear the question.
"Why is it you wish to come and work for us?"
The voice was high but soothing. Never in a million years could he have anticipated such a conversation.
"I don't want to work for anyone. I mean, I'm just a kid."
A door in the wall behind the desk slowly swung open, revealing swirling, smoky blue light. Something moved inside this brilliance, a shadow with no discernible shape that nevertheless filled him with horror.
"He wants you," said the shining personage. "He'll take anyone. He's bored, you see. But on our side we have slightly higher standards. Our margin is very slim. Nothing personal." "I can't have a job yet. I'm still in school. See..."
This was a dream. It had to be. Or maybe it was something worse. Maybe he was dying, and his mind had cobbled together this last fantasy. The thing in the room beyond moved, making the light waver. Orlando could hear it breathing, the deep, ragged inhalations coming a long time apart. It was waiting. It would wait as long as necessary.
"Well, then I suppose you might as well step through."
The figure behind the desk gestured toward the open door and the terrible something beyond.
"If you don't want the job, you shouldn't have wasted our precious office hours. Things are busy just now, what with the expansion and the merger."
The hoarse breathing became louder. Orlando knew that he did not ever want to see what made that noise.
"I've changed my mind," he said hurriedly. "I'm sorry. I want the job. Is it something to do with mathematics?"
He knew he had good scores. Wasn't that what grown-ups wanted? Good scores? He would have to ask his mother and father for permission to leave school. But when he told them about the thing in the other room, surely they would... The shining person stood. Was that rejection in the set of the shoulders? In the cold, white fire of the faceless face? Had he argued too long?
"Come and give me your hand,"
it said. Without knowing how it happened, he was standing before the desk. The figure there put out a hand which burned like phosphorus, but without heat. At the same time, he could feel the cold air billowing out from the blue-lit room, air that made his skin shrink and his eyes water. Orlando reached out.
"You must remember to do your best."
As the figure enveloped his hand with its own, he felt warmth flooding back into him so swiftly that it was almost painful.
"Your scores were good. We'll take a chance." "Don't forget Frederick's," he said, suddenly remembering. "I made him come. It's not his fault."
The thing in the room beyond made a horrid noise, part bark, part wet sob. Its shadow moved forward, darkening the doorway and quenching the cube of light that was the office, blotting out even the brilliance of the thing that held Orlando's hand. He shouted in terror and stepped back, and then he was falling again, falling. The setting sun, as it passed behind the haze that shrouded Calcutta, seemed to kindle the entire sky. An orange glow spread along the horizon, molten light against which the factory smokestacks stood in charcoal silhouette like the minarets of hell. "It has begun," he thought. "Even the skies reflect it. The dance has begun." The holy man bent and lifted his single possession from the sand, then walked slowly down to the river to wash it clean. He was finished with it now, this last tie to the illusory world of Maya. But there were rituals to be observed. He must finish properly, as he had begun. He squatted in the brown river, a delta finger of the mighty Ganges, and felt its sacred waters wash over him, thick with the effluvia of Calcutta's industrial and human waste. His skin itched and burned, but he did not hurry. He filled the bowl, and then poured the water out again, rubbing and scraping with his long fingers in all the crannies until the bowl gleamed in the dying sunlight. He held it up before him with the teeth resting on his palm and remembered the day he had come here to ready himself.
a full 2 years before. No one had troubled him as he picked through the ashes of the cremation ground. Even in the modern Indian Federation, where pulsingly new electronic nerves ran through the flesh of a nation as old and withered as humankind itself, there was still a superstitious respect for the Agori, the cremation sites to which he and a few other devotees of Shiva the Destroyer still came as pilgrims, sinking themselves in filth and carrion in the search for purity, were ceded to them, the most untouchable of untouchables. Those who believed welcomed evidence that the old ways were not completely gone. Others who had once believed turned away with a guilty shudder. And those who did not believe at all had better things to do than worry what might go on in the festering bone piles beside the great filthy river. On that day 2 years ago, when he had shed his city clothes as easily and completely as a snake sloughs its skin, he had carefully inspected every pile of human bones. Later he would return to them in search of unconsumed flesh, for the servants of Shiva eat carrion as well as live with it. But on this first day he had been searching for something more durable. He had found it at last, complete but for a jawbone, sitting on the scorched remains of a ribcage. For an idle moment he had wondered upon what scenes the empty eye sockets had once looked, what tears they had shed, what thoughts, hopes, dreams had lived in the now hollow brain case. Then he had reminded himself of the first lesson of the cremation ground. Everything comes to this. But this, too, is illusion. Just as the death represented by the nameless skull was all death, so also was it no death, merely an illusion of the material world. His mind refocused, he had taken the skull down to the riverside. As the sun, like this day's sun, had sunk down to disappear at last into the western haze, a torch doused in a basin of muddy water, he had found a sharp stone and begun to work. He had first placed the point of the stone in the middle of the forehead, in the place where a living man placed a pundra mark, then scored the bone all the way around the skull's circumference, across frontal, temporal, occipital, words from his previous life that he now discarded as easily as he had put off his clothes. The circle delineated, he had taken the sharp edge of the stone, which was nevertheless not very sharp, and begun to saw. For all his patience, he had spent that first night without a fire, in shivering nakedness, so as not to lose concentration. It had not been a simple task. Others of his kind, he knew, chose a skull which had already been weakened by fire, or which in some cases had already broken open. But with some thought of the ultimate rigors before him, he had not allowed himself such luxury. Thus it was not until the sun had reappeared in the east and turned the river to rosy copper that he lifted the top of the skull free and tossed it aside. He had taken the rest of the skull down to the river then, his first time touching the holy waters since his arrival. Although he had been feeling a thirst like fire in his throat for hours, it was not until he had sanded down the edges of the hollow on a flat rock that he allowed himself to dip it into the river and drink, as Mother Ganges' polluted waters passed down his throat, replacing the thirst with another kind of fire. He had felt a great clarity transfix him. "Lord Shiva," he had thought, "I reject the coils of Maya. I await your music." Now, as he stared at the bowl for the last time, the Agori began to speak. His voice, unused for months, was dry and faint. But he was not talking for anyone's benefit but his own.
"It came to Lord Shiva's ears that there were living in the forest of Taragam 10,000 heretical priests. These heretics taught that the universe is eternal, that souls have no lord, and that the performance of works alone is sufficient for salvation. Shiva determined to go among them and teach them the error of their ways. To Lord Vishnu, the preserver, he said, 'Come, you will accompany me. I will put upon myself the seeming of a wandering yogi, and you will put upon yourself the appearance of the yogi's beautiful wife, and we will confound these heretical rishis.' So he and Vishnu disguised themselves and went among the priests in the forest of Taragam. All the wives of the priests found themselves filled with painful longing for the powerful yogi who came to them, and all the rishis themselves were full of longing for the yogi's wife. All the business of that place was disrupted,
and there was great unrest among the priesthood. At last they decided to set a curse upon the yogi and his wife, but all of their cursings were to no effect, so the priests prepared a sacrificial fire, and from it summoned a dreadful tiger, which rushed upon Lord Shiva to destroy him. But Shiva only smiled a tender smile, then pulled the skin from the tiger, using only his little finger, and wrapped that skin about himself for a shawl. The furious rishis next evoked a terrible serpent, vast and poisonous, but Shiva smiled again and snatched it up, then hung it about his neck for a garland. The priests could not believe their eyes. Lastly, the priests brought forth a hideous black dwarf with a club that could shatter mountains. But Shiva only laughed and set his foot upon the dwarf's back, and then began to dance. Shiva's dance is the source of all movement within the universe, and the vision of it and the splendor of heaven's opening filled the hearts of the heretical priests with awe and terror. They cast themselves down before him, crying for mercy. He danced for them his five acts: creation, preservation, destruction, embodiment, and release. And when they had seen Lord Shiva's dance, the priests were freed from illusion and became his devotees, and error was forever burned from their souls. Thus it is that as the first cause, sometimes called the terror and the destroyer, dances upon darkness, he contains in himself both the life and death of all things. So for this reason his servants dwell in the cremation ground, and the heart of his servant is like the cremation ground, wasted and desolate, where the self and its thoughts and deeds are burned away, and nothing remains but the dancer himself. When he had finished speaking, he bent his head and shut his eyes. After a few moments, he set his bowl down upon the sandy soil, then lifted a heavy stone and broke the bowl to pieces. The sun had disappeared, leaving only a bloody ribbon of light stretched on the horizon behind the city. The Agori stood up and walked through the ashes and smoke to the place among the reeds where he had left his briefcase 24 months earlier, protected by a plastic bag nestled in a pile of rocks. He took it from the bag and placed his thumb against the lock, then opened it. The scent that rose from the case, to senses now used only to the smell of the charnel house, was that of another life, one that seemed impossibly different. For a moment he allowed his roughened fingers to indulge themselves against the almost unbelievable softness of the clothing that had awaited him there all this time, and marveled that he had once thoughtlessly worn such things. Then he lifted the silky bundle and took from beneath it a pad in an expensive leather case. He flipped open the lid and ran a finger across the touchscreen. It glowed into life, its spark chip still charged. He uncapped his neurocannula and swabbed it with alcohol from the briefcase pocket. There were some things for which even the sacred water of Mother Ganges was not entirely suitable. Then unspooled a fiber link from the side of the pad and plugged it in. 10 minutes later, Nandi Paradivish unplugged the fiber link and stood up. As he had anticipated, the message had been waiting. It was time to move on. He pulled on the pants and shirt, helplessly conscious of their soft feel against his skin, then sat down on a rock to don his shoes. The cremation ground had prepared him, but for the next part of his journey he must return to the city. What he needed to do next would require access to serious bandwidth. "The Grail Brotherhood have taken up their instruments, and now we of the Circle take up ours. Others have been drawn to the music too, as we guessed they would, and only Lord Shiva knows how it will end." He closed the briefcase, then made his way up the sandy bank. It was evening now, and the lights of the city glimmered before him like a jeweled necklace upon the dark breast of Parvati, the destroyer's wife. "It has begun," he told himself. "The dance has begun." Fourth, the city. And he answered and said, "Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he hath broken unto the ground." Isaiah Chapter 21, Verse 9. Chapter 33, Someone Else's Dream. Netfeed, sitcom, live. Come to buy some Sprudy.
Visual, Wung Wung Cho's dining room.
Cho, what is this? I thought someone went to get Sprudy. This is a very important meal. The regional governor is coming. You have all betrayed me.
Visual, Cho exits.
Daughter Zia shoves Chun Shua. Zia,
you are going to give my father a heart attack, Shua.
Shua,
I hear that Sprudy is a good cure for that, too.
Audio over. Laughter.
Zia,
he really believes there is such a thing. You are a very cruel man.
Shua,
is that why you love me? Or is it just because I am so beautiful?
Audio over. Laughter and applause. For a long time she lay on her back, staring up at the feverish green of the trees and the random multicolored bits of flame that she at last identified as butterflies. Where she could see it through the puzzle of leaves, the sky was awesomely deep and blue, but she could not remember who she was, or where she was, or why she should be lying on her back so empty of knowledge. At last, as she idly watched a green bird making urgent little hooting noises on a green branch above her, a memory drifted up. There had been a shadow, a cold hand upon her. Darkness, terrible darkness. Despite the moist warmth of the air and the strength of the sun beyond the filter of leaves, she shivered.
I have lost someone,
she thought suddenly. She could feel the space where that person should be.
Someone dear to me is gone.
An incomplete picture flitted through her thoughts. A small body, slender, a brown-skinned face with bright eyes.
Brother?
She wondered.
Son? Friend or lover?
She knew all the words, but could not say exactly what any of them meant. She sat up. The wind in the trees made a long sighing noise, an exhalation that surrounded her, as the trees themselves did, on all sides.
What was this place?
Then, tickling her thoughts like a cough gathering in her throat, she began to hear a word. It was only a sound at first, but in her thoughts she could hear a woman's voice saying it, a sharp sound, a sound meant to get her attention.
Irene! Irene! Irene!
It was her mother's voice, playing back from her memory like an old recording.
Irene, put that down now. Girl, you tire me out sometimes. Irene! Irene Sulawayo! Yes, Rini, I'm talking to you.
Rini. And with her name, everything else came flooding back as well. Her father's angry scowl, and Stephen's sweet face gone slack in endless sleep. Pinetown. The wreckage of Dr. Von Blake's laboratory. And then the dark thing. The terrible blackness. And old Sing shrieking without any sound.
Habu! Habu!
There was no answer but the hooting green bird. She raised her voice and tried again, then remembered Martine and called her, too.
But that's foolishness. She wouldn't be here with me. She's in France, wherever.
And this was clearly not France, and not the military base beneath the mountain, either. This was someplace else.
Where in God's name am I?
Habu! Habu, can you hear me?
The vibrant jungle swallowed her voice. It died almost without echo. Rini stood on shaky legs. The experiment had clearly failed in some terrible way. But how had it resulted in this? Her surroundings were nothing like the arid Drakensberg Mountains. This looked like some place in the north, like one of the rainforests in the West African Federation. A thought, an impossible thought, kindled in her mind.
It couldn't be.
She reached up to touch her face. Something was there. Something invisible that nevertheless had form and texture beneath her probing fingers. Something that even covered her eyes, although the green world before her demonstrated that nothing could be impeding her vision. Unless none of this was real. Rini grew dizzy. She sank slowly to her knees, then sat down. There was thick, soft soil beneath her, hot and alive with its own cycle of life. She could feel it. She could feel the serrated edge of a fallen leaf against the edge of her hand. The thought was impossible. But so was this place. The world around her was too real. She closed her eyes and opened them. The jungle would not go away. Overwhelmed, she began to weep.
It's impossible.
She had been walking for half an hour, struggling through thick vegetation.
this quality of detail, and it goes on for miles, and there's no latency at all. It just can't be.
An insect hummed past. Rini threw out her hand and felt the tiny body smack against her knuckle and bounce off. A moment later, the bright-winged thing had struggled back into flight and was zigzagging away.
No discernible latency, even at this level of complexity. What did Singh say? Trillions upon trillions of instructions per second? I've never heard of anything like this.
Suddenly she realized why the Golden City had looked the way it did. At this level of technology, almost anything was possible.
Khabu! She shouted again. Martine! Hello!
Then, a little more quietly,
Jeremiah? Is the line still working? Can you hear me? Jeremiah?
Nobody answered her except birds. So now what? If she was indeed in the network called Otherland, and if it was as big as Singh had said, she might be as horrendously far from anything useful as someone at the Antarctic would be from an Egyptian coffee house. Where had Singh meant to start? The weight of hopelessness threatened for a moment to immobilize her completely. She considered just dropping offline, but rejected the thought after only short consideration. Singh had died in that darkness, which was as much thought as she dared to give to what had happened, to get them here. It would be a terrible betrayal to do anything but go on. But go on where? She ran through a quick set of exploratory commands without result. None of the standard VR control languages seemed to be in operation, or else there were permissions necessary for users to manipulate the environment that she simply didn't have.
Someone spent an unimaginable amount of time and money to build themselves a world. Maybe they like playing God. Maybe no one else gets to do anything but visit this place and take what they get.
Rini looked up. The tree shadows had taken on a new angle, and the sky seemed just perceptibly darker.
Everything else is just like R.L., she thought. So maybe I better start thinking about a fire. Who knows what's going to be walking around here at night?
The impossibility of her situation once more threatened to overcome her. But beneath the shock and confusion and despair, there was also a tiny trace of sour humor. Who would ever have guessed that her precious, hard-earned college education, the thing that everyone had said would make her an integral part of the 21st century, would instead have led her to building imaginary fires in imaginary jungles to keep imaginary beasts at bay.
Congratulations, Rini. You are now an official imaginary primitive.
It was hopeless. Even with the trick Khabu had showed her, she could not manufacture a single spark. The wood had been too long on the damp ground.
Whoever made this bastard place had to be a stickler for detail, didn't he? Couldn't have left a few dry sticks around.
Something rustled in the bushes. Rini jerked upright and seized one of the branches, hoping it would make a better club than it had a bonfire.
What are you so afraid of? It's a simulation. So some big old leopard or something comes out of the dark and kills you, so what?
But that would probably throw her out of the network. Game over. Which would be another way of failing Singh. Stephen, everyone.
And this whole place feels too goddamn real anyway. I don't want to find out how they'd simulate me being something's dinner.
The clear place in which she had settled was scarcely 3 meters wide. The moonlight filtering down through the trees was strong, but it was still only moonlight. Anything big enough to harm her would probably be on her before she could react, and she couldn't even prepare herself for possible dangers because she had no idea where she was supposed to be. Africa? Prehistoric Asia? Something completely imaginary? Whoever could dream up a city like that could invent a whole lot of monsters, too. The rattle grew louder. Rini tried to remember the things she had read in books. Most animals, she seemed to remember, were more scared of you than you were of them. Even the big ones, like lions, preferred to avoid humans.
Assuming we have anything like real animals here.
Dismissing this bleak thought, she decided that rather than crouching in fear, hoping not to be discovered, she would be better off announcing her presence. She took a breath and began singing loudly.
Genome warriors, brave and strong, battle Mutar's evil throng, separate the right from wrong, mighty genome warriors.
It was embarrassing, but at the moment the children's show theme, one of Stephen's great favorites, was the only thing that came to her mind.
When the mutant mastermind threatens all of humankind, tries to sneak up from behind and cut genetic ties that bind.
The rustling grew louder. Reenie broke off her song and raised the club. A shaggy, strange-looking animal, somewhere between a rat and a pig in appearance, and closer in size to the latter, pushed through into the clearing.
Reenie froze.
The thing raised its snout for a moment and sniffed, but did not seem to see her. A moment later, two smaller versions of the original bumbled out of the vegetation behind it. The mother made a quiet grunting noise and herded her offspring back into the shrubbery, leaving Reenie shaken but relieved. The creature had looked vaguely familiar, but she certainly could not say she had recognized it. She still did not have any idea where she was supposed to be.
"Genome Warriors!"
she sang again, louder this time. Apparently, at least judging by the pig rat or whatever it was she had just met, the local fauna weren't aware that they were supposed to be afraid of humans.
"Bold and clean, with chromosomes so sharp and keen, they'll fight the mutomix machine, mighty genome warriors."
The moon had passed directly above her, and she had run through every song she could remember. Pop tunes, themes from various net shows, nursery rhymes, and tribal hymns, when she thought she heard a faint voice calling her name. She stood, about to shout a reply, but stopped. She was no longer in her own world. She was very evidently trapped in someone else's dream, and she could not shake off the memory of the dark something that had killed Sing and handled Reenie herself as though she were a toy. Perhaps this strange operating system, or whatever it was, had lost her when she slipped through, but was now looking for her. It sounded ridiculous, but the horrible living darkness, followed by the overpowering realness of this place, had shaken her badly. Before she could decide what to do, something decided for her. The leaves rattled overhead. Then something thumped down onto the floor of the clearing. The intruder had a head like a dog, and yellow, moon-reflecting eyes. Reenie tried to scream, but could not. Choking, she raised the thick branch. The thing skittered back and lifted surprisingly human forepaws.
"Reenie, it is me, Habu."
"Habu? What? Is that really you?" The baboon settled onto its haunches.
"I promise you. Do you remember the people who sit on their heels? I am wearing their shape, but behind the shape is me."
Oh, my God. There could be no mistaking the voice. Why would anything that could copy Habu's speech so perfectly bother to send an impostor in such a confusing shape?
"Oh, my God, it is you."
She ran forward and lifted the hairy animal body in her arms, and hugged it, and wept.
"But why do you look like that? Is it something that happened when we passed through that, whatever that was?"
Habu was using his nimble baboon fingers to apply himself to fire-making. By climbing, he had found some dead branches, comparatively dry because they had not yet fallen to the ground. A tiny wisp of smoke was now rising from the piece braced between his long feet.
"I told you that I had a dream," he said, "that it was time for all the first people to join together once more. I dreamed that it was time to repay the debt that my family owes to the people who sit on their heels. For that reason, and others that you would think more practical, I chose this as my secondary sim after a more ordinary human shape. But when I came through to this place, this was the body I had been given. I cannot find any way to make things change, so even when I did not wish to frighten you, I still had to remain in this form."
Reenie smiled. Just being reunited with Habu had lifted her spirits, and the sight of a smoldering red spot in the hollowed-out branch was lifting them higher still.
"You had practical reasons for choosing that sim? What exactly is practical about being a baboon?"
Habu gave her a long look. There was something inherently comical in the bony, overhanging brow and canine snout, but the little man's personality still made itself felt.
"Many things, Reenie. I can get to places you cannot. I was able to climb a tree to find these branches, remember? I have teeth,"
he briefly bared his impressive fangs,
"that may be useful. And I can go places and not be remarked upon, because city people do not notice animals. Even in a world as strange as this, I would guess. Considering how little we know of this network and its simulations,
I think those are all valuable commodities.
The curls of leaves had now begun to burn. As Khabu used these small flames to ignite a larger blaze, Rini reached her hands toward the warmth.
Have you tried to talk to Jeremiah?
Khabu nodded his head.
I am sure you and I have made the same discoveries.
Rini leaned back.
This is all so hard to believe. I mean, it feels incredibly real, doesn't it? Can you imagine if we had direct neural hookups?
I wish we did.
The baboon squatted, poking at the blaze.
It is frustrating not to be able to smell more things. This sim desires nose information.
I'm afraid the military didn't think smells were very important. The V-Tank equipment has a pretty rudimentary scent palette. They probably just wanted users to be able to smell equipment fires and bad air and a few other things. But beyond that, what do you mean, anyway, nose information?
Before entering into VR the first time, I had not realized how much I rely on my sense of smell, Rini. Also, perhaps because I am wearing an animal sim, the operating system of this network seems to give me slightly different... What words do you use? Sensory input. I feel I could do many things that I could never do in my other life.
A brief chill went through Rini at Khabu's mention of an other life, but he distracted her by leaning close and snuffling at her with his long muzzle. The light touch tickled, and she pushed him away.
What are you doing?
Memorizing your scent, or at least the scent our equipment gives you. If I had better tools, I would not even have to work at it. But now I think I will be able to find you, even if you get lost again.
He sounded pleased with himself.
Finding me isn't the issue. Finding us, that's the difficult part. Where are we? Where do we go? We have to do something soon. I don't care about hourglasses and imaginary cities, but my brother's dying.
I know. We must find our way out of this jungle first, I think. Then we will be able to learn more.
He rocked on his haunches, holding his tail in his hand.
I think I can tell you something about where we are, though, and when we are, too.
You can't. How could you? What did you see before you met up with me, a road sign? A tourist information booth?
He furrowed his brow. The very picture of cool simian indignation.
It is only a guess that I am making, Rini. Because there is so much we do not know about this network and its simulations, I may be wrong. But part of it is common sense. Look around us. This is a jungle, a rainforest like the Cameroon. But where are the animals?
I saw a few, and I'm sitting next to one.
He ignored this.
A few, indeed, and there are not as many birds as you would expect in such a place.
So?
So I would guess that we are quite close to the edge of the forest, and that either there is a big city nearby, or some kind of industry. I have seen it before in the real world. Either one of those would have driven many of the animals away.
Rini nodded slowly. Khabu was emotionally perceptive, but he was also just plain clever. It had been easy to underestimate him sometimes because of his small stature and the quaintness of his clothes and speech. It would be even easier to make that mistake while he wore his present appearance.
Or, if this is an invented world, someone may just have made it this way,
she pointed out.
Perhaps, but I think there is a good chance we are not far from people.
You said when as well.
If the animals have been driven away, then I suspect that the technology of this world is not too far behind our own, or even ahead. Also, there is a harsh scent in the air that I believe is part of this place, and not just an accidental product of our V-tanks. I only smelled it when the wind changed, just before I found you.
Rini, enjoying the surprisingly powerful comfort of the fire, was content to play Watson to the small man's homes.
And that scent is?
I cannot say for certain, but it is smoke more modern than that of a wood fire. I smell metal in it, and oil.
We'll see. I hope you're right. If we've got a long search ahead of us, it would be nice if it took place somewhere with hot showers and warm beds.
They fell silent, listening to the crackle of the fire. A few birds and something that sounded like a monkey called in the trees above.
What about Martine?
Rini asked suddenly.
Could you use this baboon nose of yours to find her?
Perhaps, if we were close enough. Although I do not know what smell she has in this simulation. But there is nothing that smells like you do, which is the only measure I have for a human scent, anywhere nearby.
Rini looked past the fire into the darkness. Perhaps if she and Khabu had wound up reasonably close to each other, Martine would not be too far away, if she had survived.
Khabu,
What did you experience when we were coming through?
His description brought back the goose flesh, but told her nothing new.
The last thing I heard Mr. Singh say was that it was alive, he finished. Then I had a sense of many other presences, as though I were surrounded by spirits. I woke up in the forest as you did, alone and confused.
Do you have any idea what that thing was? The thing that caught us and killed Singh? I can tell you it wasn't like any security program I've ever heard of.
It was the All-Devourer.
He spoke with flat certainty.
What are you talking about? It is the thing that hates life because it is itself empty. There is a famous story my people tell of the last days of Grandfather Mantis and how the All-Devourer came to his campfire.
He shook his head.
But I will not tell it here. Not now. It is an important story, but it is sad and frightening.
Well, whatever that thing was, I never want to go near it again. It was worse than that collie creature in Mr. J's.
Although, as she thought about it, there had been certain similarities between the two, especially the way they apparently managed to affect physical changes through virtual media. What connection might there be? And could contemplating the collie and what had happened inside the club help her understand what Khabu called the All-Devourer? Could anything help them understand? Rini yawned. It had been a long day. Her brain didn't want to work anymore. She pushed herself back against a tree trunk. At least this tropical simulation wasn't too full of insects. Perhaps she'd actually be able to get some sleep.
Khabu, come over here closer, will you? I'm getting tired, and I don't know how much longer I can stay awake.
He looked at her for a silent moment, then walked on all fours across the small clearing. He crouched beside her for an awkward moment, then stretched out and lay his head across her thighs. She idly stroked his furry neck.
I'm glad you're here. I know that you and my father and Jeremiah are really only a few meters away from me, but it still felt terribly lonely when I woke up by myself. It would have been much worse spending the whole night here alone.
Khabu did not say anything, but extended one long arm and patted her on the top of the head, then lightly touched her nose with his hairless monkey finger. Rini felt herself drifting into welcome sleep.
I can see the edge of the forest,
Khabu called, 20 meters up.
And there is a settlement.
Rini paced impatiently at the foot of the tree.
Settlement? What kind? I cannot tell from here.
He walked farther out onto the branch, which swayed in a way that made Rini nervous.
It is at least a couple of kilometers away, but there is smoke, and buildings, too. They look very simple.
He descended swiftly, then dropped to the spongy ground beside her.
I have seen what looks like a good path, but the jungle is very thick. I will have to climb up again soon and look some more, or we will spend all day tearing our way through.
You're enjoying this, aren't you? Just because we happen to wind up in a jungle, your baboon idea looks brilliant. But what if we'd wound up in the middle of an office building or something?
Come along. We have been in this place most of a day already.
He loped away. Rini followed a little more slowly, cursing the thick vegetation.
Some path,
she thought. They stood, sheltering in the darkness of the forest's edge. Before them lay a descending slope of reddish mud, pimpled with the stumps of cut trees and scarred with the ruts of their removal.
It's a logging camp,
Rini whispered.
It looks modern, sort of.
A number of large vehicles were parked in the cleared area below. Small shapes moved among them, cleaning and adjusting them like mahouts tending elephants. The machinery was large and impressive, but from what Rini could see, there were odd anachronisms as well. None of them had the tank-like treads she was accustomed to seeing on heavy construction equipment. Instead, they had fat wheels covered with studs. Several of them also seemed to be powered by steam boilers. The row of huts beyond, however, clearly made from some prefabricated material, were indistinguishable from things she had seen on the outskirts of Durban. In fact, she knew people, some of them students of hers, who had lived their whole lives in such huts.
Just remember, stay close to me, she said. We don't know how they feel about wild animals here, but if you hold my hand, they'll probably accept that you're a pet.
Khabu was becoming quite adept at using the baboon face. His expression clearly said that she should enjoy this small reversal of fortune while she could. As they made their way down the slippery hillside beneath the gray morning sky, Rini for the first time had a view of the countryside. Beyond the camp, a wide dirt road cut through the jungle. The land around it was largely flat. Rising mist obscured the horizon and made the trees seem to stretch endlessly. The camp's inhabitants were dark-skinned, but not as dark as she was, and most that she could see had straight black hair. Their clothing gave no clues as to time or place, since most of them wore only pants, and their choice of footgear was hidden by red mud. One of the nearest workers spotted her and shouted something to the others. Minnie turned to stare.
"Take my hand," she whispered to Khabu. "Remember, baboons don't talk in most places."
One of the workmen had ambled off, perhaps to alert the authorities, or maybe to get weapons, Rini thought. How isolated was this place? What did it mean to be an unarmed woman in such a situation? It was frustrating to have so little knowledge, like being transported by surprise to another solar system and dumped off the starship with nothing but a picnic basket. A silent half-circle of workers formed as Rini and Khabu approached, but remained at a distance that might have been respectful or superstitious. Rini stared boldly back at them. The men were mostly small and wiry, their features vaguely Asian, like pictures she remembered of the Mongols of steppe country. Some of them wore bracelets of a translucent jade-like stone, or wore amulets of metal and mud-draggled feathers on thongs around their necks. A man wearing a shirt and a wide-brimmed conical straw hat bustled up from behind the gathering crowd of workers. He was thickly muscled, with a long, sharp nose, and had a paunch that hung over his colorful belt. Rini guessed he must be the foreman.
"Do you speak English?"
she asked. He paused, looked her up and down, then shook his head. "No. What is it?" Rini's confusion passed in a moment. Apparently the simulation had built-in translation facilities, so she seemed to be speaking the foreman's language, and he hers. As she continued the conversation, she saw that his mouth movements did not quite match his words, confirming her guess. She also noticed that he had a pierced lower lip with a small gold plug in it.
"I am sorry. I am lost. I have had an accident."
Inwardly, she cursed. In all the time they had spent struggling through the jungle, she had given no thought to a cover story. She decided to wing it.
"I was with a group of hikers, but I got separated from them."
Now she just had to hope the custom of walking for pleasure existed in this place. Apparently it did. "You are far from any towns," he said, looking at her with a certain shrewd good humor, as though he guessed she hadn't told him the truth, but wasn't too bothered about it. "Still, it is bad to be lost and far from home. My name is Tak. Come with me." As they walked across the encampment, Khabu, still silent at Rini's side, uncommented upon despite all the stares he received, she tried to get a better fix on what sort of place this was. The foreman looked as Asiatic or Middle Eastern as any of the laborers. On his belt was something that looked like a field telephone. It had a short antenna, but was cylindrical and covered with carvings. Something that very much resembled a satellite dish also stood atop one of the larger huts. It didn't add up to any recognizable pattern. The satellite hut proved to be Tak's office and home. He sat Rini down in a chair in front of his metal desk and offered her a cup of something that did not fully translate, which she accepted. Khabu crouched beside her seat, wide-eyed. The room in which they sat offered no more definitive clues. There were a few books on a shelf, but the writing on their spines was in strange glyphs she could not read. Apparently, the translation algorithms served only for speech. There was also a shrine of some sort, a box-like affair with a frame of colorful feathers, which contained several small wooden figures of people with animal heads.
"I can't figure this place out at all," she whispered.
Khabu's small fingers squeezed her hand, warning her that the foreman was returning. Rini thanked him as she took the steaming cup, then lifted it to her face and sniffed it, before remembering that, as Khabu had complained, the V-tank gave her a very limited sense of smell. But the mere fact that she had tried to smell it suggested that this place was already impairing her VR reflexes. If she didn't stay vigilant, she could easily forget that it wasn't real. She had to lift the cup carefully, feeling for her lips to make sure she was placing it correctly, since her mouth was the one spot where she had no sensitivity. It was like trying to drink after having been anesthetized at the dentist's office. "What sort of monkey is that?" Tak squinted at Khabu. "I have not seen one like it before."
I don't know. It was given to me by a friend
who traveled a lot. It is a very faithful pet. Tok nodded. Winnie was relieved to see that the word seemed to translate.
How long have you been lost?
He asked. Winnie decided to stick close to the truth, which always made lying easier. I spent one night in the jungle by myself.
How many? How many of you were there?
She hesitated, but her course had been set. There were two of us, not including my pet monkey, who got separated from the rest, and then I lost her as well.
He nodded again, as though this jibed with some personal calculation. And you are a Temiluni, of course?
This was slightly deeper water, but Rini took a chance. Yes, of course. She waited, but this also seemed to confirm the foreman's casual suspicions.
You people, you town folk, you think you can just walk in the jungle like it was... Some name she could not quite grasp. Park. But the wild places are not like that. You should be more careful with your life and health. Still, the gods are sometimes good to fools and wanderers.
He looked upward, then muttered something and made a sign on his breast.
I will show you something.
Come. He stood up and walked around the desk, beckoning Rini toward the door at the back of the office. On the other side was the foreman's living quarters, with a table, a chair, and a bed canopied by a curtain of mosquito netting. As he stepped toward the bed and pulled back the gauzy netting, Rini braced herself against the wall, wondering if he was expecting some kind of exchange of favors for her rescue. But there was already someone there. The sleeping woman was small and dark-haired, and long-nosed like Tok, dressed in a simple white cotton dress. Rini did not recognize her. End of side 20. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.
Side 21. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 652. As she stood frozen, unsure of what to do, Khabu loped to the bed and jumped up beside the woman, then began to bounce up and down on the thin mattress. He was clearly trying to tell her something, but it took her a long moment to understand. Martine? She hurried forward. The woman's eyes fluttered open, the pupils roving, unfixed. The way... blocked. Martine, if this was her, lifted her hands as though to ward off some looming danger. The voice was not familiar, and there was no French accent. But the next words dispelled any doubt. No, Sing, do not... Oh, my God, how terrible! Rini's eyes stung with tears as she watched her companion thrashing on the bed, apparently still in the grip of the nightmare that had awaited them at Otherland's shadowy border. Oh, Martine! She turned to the foreman, who was watching the reunion with grave self-satisfaction. Where did you find her? Tok explained that a party of tree-markers had discovered her wandering dazedly at the edge of the jungle, a short distance from the camp. The men are superstitious, he said. They think her touched by the gods. Again the reflexive gesture. But I suspected it was hunger and cold and fear, perhaps even a blow on the head. The foreman returned to his work, promising that they could have a ride back with the next convoy of logs, leaving at twilight. Rini, overwhelmed by events, neglected to ask where back might be. She and Khabu spent the dwindling afternoon sitting beside the bed holding Martine's hands and speaking soft words to her when the nightmares seemed to pursue her too closely. The foreman, Tok, helped Rini up into the back of the huge, gleaming, steam-powered truck. Khabu clambered up by himself and sat next to her atop the chained logs. Tok made her promise that she and her mad Temiluni friends would not wander around in the wild country any more. She did, and thanked him for his kindness as the convoy pulled out of the camp and onto the broad, muddy road. Weenie could have ridden in one of the other truck cabs, but she wanted the privacy to talk to Khabu. Also, Martine was belted into the passenger seat of this truck, whose driver, Rini had noticed with interest, was a broad-faced, broad-shouldered woman, and Rini wanted to stay close to their ill companion.
So that's not Martine's voice, because she's delirious and she's speaking French, I suppose, she said as they bumped out of camp. But why do you have your voice and I have mine? I mean, you sound like you, even though you look like something out of a zoo.
Khabu, who was standing upright, leaning into the wind and sniffing, did not answer.
We must have all been piggybacked on Sing's index, she reasoned, and that index was marked English-speaking. Of course, that doesn't explain why I kept this body, but you got your second-choice Sim. She looked down at her own copper-skinned hands. Just as Khabu had wound up with a good body for jungle wandering, she had chosen one that seemed physically very close to the local human norm. Of course, if they had landed in a Viking village or in World War II Berlin, she wouldn't have fit in quite so well. Khabu clambered down and crouched beside her again. His erect tail curved like a strung bow. "We have found Martine, but we still do not know what we are searching for," he said, "or where we are going." Rini looked out at the miles of thick green jungle lying behind them in the dying light, and the miles that the strip of red road still had to cross. "You had to remind me, didn't you?" They drove through the night. The temperature was tropical, but Rini soon learned that virtual logs made no better a bed than real ones. What was particularly annoying was knowing that her real body was floating in a V-tank full of adjustable gel, which could have been made to simulate the softest goose down, if she could only work the controls. As the sun came up, ending a darkness that had brought Rini very little rest, the trucks reached a town. It was apparently the home of the sawmill and processing facilities, and something of a jungle metropolis. Even at first light, there were scores of people on the muddy streets. A handful of Land Rover-like cars rolled past as they drove down the wide main thoroughfare, some clearly powered by steam, others more mysteriously. Rini also spotted more of the objects that looked like satellite dishes, which seemed restricted to the largest buildings. But in many other ways the town looked as though it might have been transplanted whole from the set of some saga of the American West. The wooden sidewalks were raised above the clinging muck. The long town-bisecting Main Street seemed designed for gunfights, and there were as many horses as cars. A few men even seemed to be having an early morning brawl outside one of the local taverns. These men, and the other people Rini could see, were better dressed than the jungle workers. But except for the fact that many wore shawls of brightly dyed woven wool, she still could not put her finger on anything definitive in their clothing styles. The trucks rattled through town and lined up on the vast mudflat outside the sawmill. The driver of Rini's truck got out, and with a certain taciturn courtesy, suggested she and her sick friend and their pet monkey might as well stop here. As she helped Rini unload the semi-conscious Martine from the cab, the driver suggested they could find a bus in front of the town hall. Rini was relieved to know there was somewhere else beyond this place.
"A bus? That's wonderful. But I don't have any money."
The truck driver stared at her. "You need money for city buses now?" she said at last. "By all the lords of heaven, what shit will the council think of next? The God King ought to execute them all and start over." As the driver's surprise had suggested, the buses were apparently free. Rini, with surreptitious assistance from Khabu, was able to help Martine stumble the short distance to the town hall, where they took a seat on the steps to wait. The Frenchwoman still seemed to be caught in those terrible moments when they had broken into the Otherland system and everything had gone so badly wrong, but she was able to move around almost normally when prompted, and once or twice Rini even felt a returned pressure when she squeezed Martine's hand, as though something inside was struggling toward the surface.
"I hope so," Rini thought. "Without Sing, she's the only hope we've got of making any sense of this."
She looked out at the utterly foreign, yet utterly realistic surroundings, and felt almost ill.
"Who am I kidding? Look at this place. Think of the sort of minds and money and facilities it took to make this. And we're going to put the ringleaders under citizen's arrest or something? This whole venture was ridiculous from the very beginning."
The sensation of helplessness was so powerful that Rini could not summon the will to speak. She, Khabu, and Martine sat on the steps in silence, an oddly assorted trio that received its due in the covert stares and whispers of the local populace. Rini thought the jungle might be thinning a little, but she wasn't positive. After watching an uncountable number of trees go by, hour upon hour, she was seeing the monotonous landscape slide past even when she closed her eyes.
The gold-toothed, feather-medallion-bedecked bus driver had not batted an eye at her two unusual companions. But when Rini had asked him where the bus went, whatever information was printed over the windscreen was illegible to her, like the foreman's books. He had stared as though she had asked him to make the battered old vehicle fly. "To Melun, good woman," he had said, lowering his chunky sunglasses to examine her more closely, perhaps thinking that someone might ask him later to describe the escaped madwoman. "The city of the God-King, praise to his name, the Lord of life and death, he who is favored above all others. Where else would it go?" He gestured to the single straight road leading out of the sawmill town. "Where else could it go?" Now, with Khabu standing in her lap, his hands pressed against the window, and Martine sleeping against her shoulder, Weenie tried to make sense of all she had learned. The place seemed to have 19th and 20th century technologies mixed up together, so far as she could remember the differences between the two. The people looked something like Asians or Middle Easterners, although she had seen a few in the town who had fairer or darker appearances. The foreman hadn't heard of English, so that might indicate a great distance from English-speaking peoples, or a world in which there was no English at all, or just that the foreman was ignorant. They seemed to have at least one well-established religion, and a god-king. But was that a person or a figure of speech? And the truck driver had made it sound as if there were some kind of governing council. Rini sighed miserably. Not much to go on at all. They were wasting time. Precious, precious time. But she couldn't think of a single thing they could do differently. Now they were headed to Temelun, which apparently was an even larger town, and if nothing there brought them closer to their goal, then what? On to the next? Was this foray, for which Singh had paid with his life, going to be just bus trip after bus trip? One long, bad holiday? Khabu turned from the window and put his head next to her ear. He had been quiet during the journey so far, since there were passengers crammed into every possible space on all the seats and in the aisles, half a dozen at least just within a meter radius of Rini's cramped seat. Many of these passengers were also transporting chickens or small animals Rini couldn't quite identify, which explained the bus driver's disinterest in Khabu. But none of these creatures showed any inclination to talk, which was why the baboon in Rini's lap now whispered very quietly, "I have been thinking and thinking what we must look for," he said. "If we are seeking the people who own this other land network, then we first must discover something of who wields the power in this world." "And how do we do that?" Weenie murmured. "Go to a library? I suppose they must have them, but we'll probably have to find a pretty large town." Khabu spoke a bit louder now, because a woman seated in front of them had begun singing, a wordless chant that reminded Rini a little of the tribal odes her father and his friends sometimes sang when the beer had been flowing freely.
"Or perhaps we will have to befriend someone who can tell us what we need to know."
Rini looked around, but no one was paying attention to either of them. Beyond the windows, she could see cleared farming land and a few houses, and thought they must be drawing close to the next town.
"But how can we trust anyone? I mean, any single person on this bus could be wired right into the operating system. They're not real, Khabu. Most of them can't be anyway."
His reply was interrupted by a pressure on her arm. Martine was leaning toward her, clutching as though to save herself from falling. Her Sim's eyes still wandered, unfocused, but the face showed a new alertness.
"Martine, it's Rini. Can you hear me? The darkness is very thick."
She sounded like a lost child, but for the first time the voice was recognizably hers.
"You're safe,"
Rini whispered urgently.
"We've come through. We're in the other land network."
The face turned, but the eyes did not make contact.
"Rini?" "Yes, it's me. And Khabu's here, too. Did you understand what I just said? We've come through. We're in."
Martine's grip did not slacken, but the look of anxiety on her bony face softened.
"So much,"
she said.
"There is so much."
She struggled to collect herself.
"There has been much darkness."
Khabu was squeezing Rini's other arm. She was beginning to feel like the mother of too many children.
Can't you see us, Martine? Your eyes aren't focusing.
The woman's face went slack for a moment, as if she had been dealt an unexpected blow.
Something has happened to me. I am not yet myself.
She turned her face toward Rini.
Tell me, what has happened to Sing?
He's dead, Martine. Whatever that thing was, it got him. I swear I felt it kill him.
Martine shook her head miserably.
Me also. I had hoped I dreamed it.
Habu was squeezing harder. Rini reached down to lift his hand away, but saw that he was staring out the window.
Habu?
Look, Rini, look!
He did not whisper. A moment later, she, too, forgot her caution. The bus had turned in a wide bend, and for the first time she could see a horizon beyond the trees. A flat band of silver lay along the distant skyline, a span of shimmering reflection which could only be water, a bay or an ocean by the size of it, but it was what lay before it, silhouetted against its metallic sheen in complicated arcs and needles, glittering in the afternoon sun like the largest amusement park that ever was, that had riveted the disguised bushman, and now brought Rini halfway out of her seat.
Oh,
she breathed.
Oh, look.
Martine stirred impatiently.
What is it? It's the city, the Golden City.
It took an hour to reach Temelun. Crossing a great plain full of settlements, farming villages surrounded by fields of swaying grain at first, followed by thicker concentrations of suburban housing and ever-increasing modernity, shopping complexes and motorway overpasses and signs festooned with unreadable glyphs. And always the city grew larger on the horizon. Rini made her way down the aisle toward the front of the bus so she could get a better look. She slid between a pair of pierce-lipped men who were joking with the driver and hung swaying on the pole by the front door to watch a dream become reality. It seemed in some ways a thing out of a storybook. The tall buildings so completely different than the tower blocks and functional skyscrapers of Durban. Some were vast stepped pyramids, with gardens and hanging plants at every level. Others were filigreed towers of a type she had never seen, huge spires that nevertheless had been built to suggest piles of flowers or sheaves of grain. Others, as wildly uncategorizable as abstract sculpture, had angles and protrusions that seemed architecturally impossible. All were painted, the bright colors adding to the impression of floral profusion. But the single most common color was the flashing yellow of gold. Shining gold capped the tallest pyramids, and wound in barber pole stripes up the tall towers. Some of the buildings had been plated top to bottom, so even the darkest recesses, the most deeply gouged niches, still gleamed. It was everything the blurry, captured image salvaged in Susan's lab had suggested, and more. It was a city built by lunatics, but lunatics who had been touched by genius. As the bus jounced through the outer rings of the metropolis, the tops of the tall buildings rose out of sight above the windows. Rini pushed through the crowding passengers and returned to her seat, breathless.
It's incredible.
She could not shake off what she knew to be a dangerous kind of exhilaration.
I can't believe we found it. We found it!
Martine had been very quiet. Still, without speaking, she reached out and took Rini's hand, pulling her thoughts in another direction. Here, in the midst of the larger miracle, was a small one. Martine, the mystery woman, the voice without a face, had become a real person. True, she was using a sim body in the way that a puppeteer used a marionette, and she was thousands of miles away from Rini's real body, and even farther away from this purely theoretical place, but she was here. Rini could feel her, could even tell something about her real physical self. It was as though Rini had finally met a treasured childhood pen pal. Unable to express this odd happiness, she only squeezed Martine's hand. The bus stopped at last, deep in the golden-shadowed canyons of the city. Martine could now walk fairly well under her own power. She and Rini and Habu waited impatiently for the other passengers to file out before making their way down onto the tiled floor of the bus station. A vast, hollow pyramid
braced with mammoth beams which rose level upon level like a kaleidoscopic spider web. They had only a few moments to appreciate its high-ceilinged magnificence before a pair of men in dark clothing stepped in front of them.
"Excuse me," one of them said. "You have just come on the bus from Arakataka, yes?"
Rainey's mind raced, but to no useful purpose. They wore overcoats with small ceremonial capes, and both had a look of hard-faced professionalism. Any hope that they might be particularly stern ticket-takers slipped away when she looked at the oddly ceremonial-looking clubs at their belts and their polished black helmets shaped like the heads of snarling jungle cats.
"Yes, we were..."
"Then you will show me your identification, please."
Helplessly, Rini patted the pockets of her jumpsuit. Martine stared into space, her expression that of someone lost in a daydream.
"If the show is for our benefit, you may dispense with it."
Beneath the high-crowned helmet, his head appeared to be shaved.
"You are outsiders. We have been expecting you."
He stepped forward and took Rini's arm. His partner hesitated for a moment, staring at Khabu.
"The monkey will come with us too, of course,"
the first policeman said.
"I am sure none of you wish to delay any further, so let us go. Please content yourself that you will be transported to the great palace with all dispatch. Those are our orders."
Khabu lowered his head, then took Rini's hand and followed docilely as the policeman walked them through the station toward the doors.
"What are you doing with us?"
Rini did not feel there was much purpose in it, but she did not want to give in without trying.
"We haven't done anything. We were hiking in the country and got lost. I have my papers at home."
The policeman threw the door open. Parked just outside was a large panel truck that vented steam like a sleeping dragon. The second policeman pulled open the doors at the back and helped Martine up into the shadowed interior.
"Please, good woman."
The first policeman's voice was cold.
"Everything will be better if you save your questions for our masters. We have been ordered days ago to wait for you. Besides, you should be honored. The council seems to have special plans for all of you."
When Rini and Khabu had been ushered inside with Martine, the door was slammed shut. There were no windows. The darkness was complete.
"We've been here hours."
Rini had paced the same figure eight across the small cell so many times that she was now doing it with her eyes closed as she struggled to make sense of things. All that she had seen, the jungle, the magnificent city, and now this bleak stone dungeon out of a bad horror story, swirled in front of her mind's eye. But she could make no sense of them.
"Why all this show? If they're going to hypnotize us, or whatever that collie thing tried on me before, why not just do it? Aren't they afraid we'll just drop offline?"
"Perhaps we cannot," said Khabu. Soon after the policeman locked them in, he had climbed to the single high window, and after ascertaining that it was covered with a metal grate sufficiently fine to prevent a medium-sized monkey slipping through, had climbed back down and squatted in the corner. He had even slept there for a while, something that Rini found inexplicably annoying.
"Perhaps they know something about it we do not. Do we dare to try?"
"Not yet," said Martine. "It might not work. They have already proved they can manipulate our minds in ways we do not understand. And even if we can, we will have admitted defeat.
In any case, these are the people who we're looking for."
Rini stopped and opened her eyes. Her friends looked up at her with what she felt sure was the near indifference of the helpless. But she herself was struggling against mounting rage.
"If I didn't know it already, I'd be able to guess just from the way those slick, self-satisfied policemen acted. These are the people who've tried to kill us. Who did kill Dr. Von Blake and Singh, and God knows how many others. And they're as proud of themselves as can be. Arrogant bastards."
"It will not help to be angry,"
Martine said gently.
"It won't? Well, what will help? Saying we're sorry? That we'll never interfere with their horrible goddamned games again? So please send us back with just a warning?"
She balled her hands into fists and swung at the air.
"Shit! I am so tired of being pushed and chased and scared and manipulated by these monsters!"
"Rini,"
Martine began,
"don't tell me not to get angry. Your brother isn't lying in a quarantined hospital. Your brother isn't a vegetable kept alive by machines, is he? Your brother who counted on you to protect him?
No, Rini. They have not hurt my family as they have yours.
She realized she was crying, and wiped at her eyes with the back of her hand.
I'm sorry, Martine, but...
The door to the cell clanked, and then slid open. The same two policemen stood there, ominous black shapes in the shadowy corridor. Come along. He who is favored above all others wants to see you.
Why don't you run away?
Rini whispered fiercely.
You could hide somewhere and then help us break out. I can't believe you're not even going to try.
Habu's look, even filtered through the baboon countenance, was pained.
I would not leave you, knowing as little as we do about this place. Besides, if it is our minds they seek to affect, then we are stronger together.
The first policeman looked over his shoulder at them, irritated by the whispering. They climbed a long flight of stairs, then entered a wide hall with a polished stone floor. By the shape and the height of the roof, Rini guessed that they were inside another one of the pyramids she had seen from the bus. A crowd of dark-haired people in various kinds of ceremonial dress, most of which featured capes similar to those the police wore, bustled in all directions. This multitude, full of hurry and self-obsessed energy, paid no particular attention to the prisoners. The only ones who showed any real interest were the half-dozen armed guards standing before the doors at the far end of the hall. These bulky men had animal helmets even more garishly realistic than those of the police, long antique-looking rifles and very functional-looking clubs, and seemed like they might enjoy the chance to hurt someone. As Rini and the others approached, there was an anticipatory straightening of the ranks. But after examining the policemen's emblems with great care, the guards reluctantly stepped aside and swung the doors open. Rini and her friends were pushed through. But their captors remained outside as the doors closed again. They were alone in a chamber almost as large as the hall they had just left. The stone walls were painted with scenes of fantastical battles between men and monsters. At the center of the room, in the pool of light cast by an electrified chandelier of wide and grotesque design, stood a long table surrounded by empty chairs. The farthest chair was considerably higher than the others, and had a canopy of what looked to be solid gold in the form of the sun's disk blazing through clouds.
The council is not here. I thought you might be interested to see the meeting place, though. A figure stepped from behind the massive chair. A tall youth with the same hawk-like features as the rest of the inhabitants. He was naked above the waist, except for a long cloak of feathers, a necklace of beads and sharp teeth, and a high crown of gold, studded with blue stones.
Normally I am surrounded by minions, numberless as the sands, is how the priests put it, and they are nearly right.
His accented English was softly spoken, but there was an unmistakable core of sharp, hard intelligence behind the cold eyes. If this man wanted something, he would get it. He was also clearly much older than he appeared.
But there are quite a few other guests expected, so we shall need our space. And anyway, I thought it best we have our conversation in private.
He showed a wintry smile.
The priests would be apoplectic if they knew that the God King was alone with strangers.
Who are you?
Rini struggled to keep her voice steady, but the knowledge that she faced one of their persecutors made it impossible.
The God King of this place, as I told you, the Lord of Life and Death. But if it will make you more comfortable, let me introduce myself properly. You are guests, after all. My name is Bolivar Atasco.
Chapter 34 Butterfly and Emperor. Netfeed News. Refugee Camp Given Nation Status.
Visual. Refugee City on Merida Beach.
V.O. The Mexican refugee encampment called the End of the Road by its residents has been declared a country by the United Nations. Merida, a small city on the northern tip of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, has swollen to 4 million residents because of a series of killer storms along the coast and political instability in Honduras, Guatemala, and northeastern Mexico.
Visual.
UN truck being driven through frenzied crowd. The 3.5 million refugees are almost entirely without shelter, and many are suffering from tuberculosis, typhoid, and Guantanamo fever. By making Merida a nation in its own right, the UN can now declare martial law and bring the new country under its direct jurisdiction.
Save Orlando! You were right! You were right!
Fredericks was leaping up and down on the beach, almost crazy with excitement and terror.
Where are we? What happened? That's it! You were right!
Orlando could feel sand beneath the palms of his hand, hot and gritty and undeniable. He scooped up a handful and let it pour away again. It was real. It was all real. And the city, wilder and more wonderful than anything in a fairy tale. The Golden City was real, too, stretching almost as far as he could see, reaching toward the sky in a profusion of towers and pyramids as ornate as Russian Easter eggs. The thing that had haunted him was now just a few miles away, separated from him only by an expanse of blue ocean. He was sitting on a beach, an inarguable beach, staring at his own dream. And before that, he had passed through a nightmare, that darkness, and then that thing, that hungry, horrid thing. But it wasn't only a dream. There was something real behind it, like it was a puppet show. Like my mind was trying to make sense of something too big to understand. There was more wrong than just the nightmare. Wherever he was, he had not left the illnesses of his real body behind. The city stood in front of him. The couldn't-be city. The don't-dare-hope city. And yet he could barely force himself to care. He was melting like a candle giving off too much heat. A big, hot something inside him was eating away at his thoughts, filling his head and pressing behind his eyes. Where are we? Fredericks was still jumping up and down in an ecstasy of uncertainty. As Orlando struggled to his feet, he realized that the Fredericks he was looking at was wearing the body of Piflet, arch-thief of the Middle Country. That's wrong, he thought, but could not pursue it any farther. Standing up had only made him feel worse. The golden daubed city suddenly tilted, and Orlando tried to follow it, but instead the sand jumped up to meet him, slamming against him as though it were one solid thing.
Something in the dark touched me.
The world was spinning, spinning. He closed his eyes and went away. Piflet the thief was shaking him. Orlando's head felt like a rotten melon. At every wobble it seemed about to burst.
Orlando?
Frederick seemed to have no idea how much his voice was making Orlando's bones ache.
Are you okay? Sick. Stop shaking.
Fredericks let go. Orlando rolled onto his side, hugging himself. He could feel the bright sun beating down on his skin, but it was a weather report from another part of the country. Deep inside him, there was now a chill resistant to any sun, real or simulated. He felt the first shivers begin.
You're shivering,
Fredericks pointed out. Orlando gritted his teeth, lacking the strength even to be sarcastic.
Are you cold? But it's hot. No, what does that matter? Sorry, man. We need to put something over you. All you're wearing is that loincloth.
Fredericks looked around, scanning the empty tropical beach as though someone might have thoughtfully left a down comforter behind one of the lava rocks. He turned back to Orlando as another thought struck him.
Why are you in your Thargor sim? When did you put that on?
Orlando could only groan. Fredericks knelt beside him. His eyes were still wide, pupils pinned like a lab animal given too much of something strong. But he was struggling his way back to some kind of logic.
Here, you can have my cloak.
He untied it and draped it around Orlando's shoulders. Beneath, he was wearing his character's usual gray shirt and breeches.
But hey, this is Piflet's cloak. Am I Piflet like your Thargor?
Orlando nodded weakly.
But I never... This is scanny.
Fredericks paused.
Feel this. It feels real. Orlando, where are we? What happened? Is this somewhere on the net? Nobody on the net has equipment like this.
He struggled to keep his teeth from chattering. The clicking made his head hurt even more.
We're... I don't know where we are. But there's the city, just like you told me.
Fredericks wore the look of a jaded child who has unexpectedly encountered the actual Santa Claus.
That is the city you meant, right?
He laughed, a little shrilly.
Of course it is. What else would it be?
But where are we? Orlando was finding it difficult to keep track of Frederick's overstressed chattering. He wrapped the cloak tighter and lay down to ride out another wave of shivers. I think I have to sleep for a few minutes. Blackness reached out for him again, gathering him in. Orlando floated through fever dreams of stone tombs and Uncle Jingle singing, and his mother searching through the halls of their house for something she had lost. Once he surfaced to feel Frederick's holding his hand. "Think it's an island," his friend was saying. "There's a temple or something made out of stones, but I don't think anyone uses it anymore. And that's about it. I couldn't get all the way to the other side, because there's like an amazingly thick forest. Well, more like a jungle. But I think because of the way the beaches curve..." Orlando slid down again. As he bobbed in the buffeting currents of his illness, he snatched at the few thoughts swimming past which seemed part of reality. The monkey children had wanted to take him to someone. An animal? An animal name? Who knew about the Golden City? But instead, they had all been seized by something that had shaken him almost to pieces, as a dog grabs and dispatches a rat. A dog. Something about a dog. And now he was somewhere else. And the city was there. So he must be dreaming, because the city was a dream thing. But Frederick's was in the dream, too. Another thought, cold and hard as a stone, dropped into his fevered mind. I'm dying. I'm in that horrible Crown Heights Medical Center, and I'm strapped onto a bunch of machines. The life is draining out of me, and all that's left is this one little part of my mind, making a whole world out of a few brain cells and a few memories. And Vivian and Conrad are probably sitting next to the bed practicing their coping with grief skills, but they don't know I'm still in here. I'm still in here, trapped in the top floor of a burning building, and the flames are climbing up one story at a time, and all the firefighters are giving up and going home. I'm still in here. Orlando, wake up. You're having a bad dream or something. Wake up. I'm here. He opened his eyes. A gummy smear of pink and brown slowly became Frederick's. I'm dying. For a moment his friend looked frightened, but Orlando saw him push it down. No, you're not, Gardner. You've just got the flu or something. Oddly, watching Frederick's decide to say something encouraging, despite the unlikeliness of it being true, made him feel better. Any hallucination in which Frederick's acted so much like Frederick's was pretty much as good as real life. Not that he seemed to have a lot of choice, anyway. The chills had subsided, at least for the moment. He sat up, still holding the cloak tightly around himself. His head felt like it had been boiled until his brains had turned to steam and hissed out. "Did you say something about an island?" Relieved, Frederick's sat down next to him. With the oddly sharp focus of someone whose fever is in remission, Orlando noted the brisk, bear-like clumsiness of his friend's movements. "He certainly doesn't move like a girl." The actual fact of Frederick's sex was beginning to recede into the distance. For a moment, he wondered about what Frederick's, Salome Frederick's, really looked like. Then he pushed the thought aside. Here he looked like a boy. He moved like one. He said to treat him like one. Who was Orlando to argue? "I think this is. An island, I mean. I was looking in case there was some way to get a boat. I thought I could even steal one, since I seem to be pifflet right now. But there's no one here but us." Frederick's had been staring out at the amusement park intricacy of the city just across the water. But now he turned back to Orlando. "Why am I pifflet anyway? What do you think is going on?" Orlando shook his head. "I don't know. I wish I did. Those kids were going to take us to meet someone. Then they said something about a big hole to somewhere, and that they were going to hook us up." He shook his head again. It felt inordinately heavy. "I just don't know." Pithlet waved his hand in front of his own face, frowning as he watched it. "I've never heard of anywhere on the net like this. Everything moves just like in real life. And there are smells. Everything. Look at the ocean." "I know. So what do we do now?" "I say we build a raft." Orlando stared at the city. Seeing it so close, so actual, he had misgivings. How could anything that solid-looking live up to all the dreams he had invested in it? A raft? How are we going to do that? Did you bring your Mr. Carpenter toolkit? Frederick's made a disgusted face. "There's palm trees and vines and stuff. Your sword's lying right over there. We can do it." He scrambled across the sand and picked up the blade. "Hey,
This isn't Life Reaper.
Orlando stared at the simple hilt, the bare blade so naked compared to Life Reaper's rune-scribed length. His burst of energy was wearing off, his thoughts dulling at the edges.
It's my first sword, the one Thargor had when he first came into the Middle Country. He got Life Reaper just about a year before you came in.
He looked down at his sandaled feet sticking out from beneath the cloak.
I bet there isn't any gray in my hair, either.
Is there? Fredericks examined him.
No. I've never seen Thargor without a few streaks of gray.
How did you know? He was feeling very tired again.
Because these sandals, the sword, I'm the young Thargor. When he first came down from the Borikar Hills, he didn't get the gray hair until the first time he fought Drerajar, down in the Well of Souls.
But why? Orlando shrugged and slowly lowered himself back to the ground, ready to surrender again to the soft tug of sleep.
I don't know, Frederico. I don't know anything.
He slid in and out of sleep as light turned into darkness. Once he was pulled almost completely to wakefulness by someone screaming, but the sound came from far away and might have been another dream. There was no sign of Fredericks. Orlando wondered dimly if his friend had gone off to investigate the noises, but his thoughts were clotted with fatigue and illness, and nothing else seemed very important. It was light again. Someone was crying, and this noise was close by. It made Orlando's head hurt. He groaned and tried to fold his pillow over his ears, but his grasping fingers were full of sand. He pulled himself upright. Fredericks was kneeling a few feet away, face in hands, shoulders shaking. The morning was bright. The virtual beach and ocean made even sharper and more surreal by what was left of the night's fever.
Fredericks, are you all right?
His friend looked up. Tears were streaming down the thief's face. The simulation had even reddened his cheeks. But most impressive of all was the haunted expression in his eyes.
Oh, Gardner, we're so locked!
Fredericks caught at a hitching breath.
We are in bad, bad trouble.
Orlando felt like a sack of wet cement.
What are you talking about? We're trapped. We can't go offline.
Orlando sighed and let himself slump back onto the ground.
We're not trapped.
Fredericks crawled swiftly across the intervening distance and grabbed his shoulder.
Damn it, don't give me that! I went off and it almost killed me!
He had never heard his friend sound quite so upset.
Killed you? I wanted to go offline. I was getting more and more worried about you, and I thought maybe your parents were out somewhere and didn't know you were sick, like you might need an ambulance or something. But when I tried, I couldn't unplug. I couldn't make any of the usual commands work, and I couldn't feel anything that isn't part of this simulation. Not my room, not anything.
He reached up to his neck again, but this time more carefully.
And there's no T-Jack. Go on, you try.
Orlando reached up to the spot where his own neurocannula had been implanted. He could feel nothing but Thargor's heavy musculature.
Yeah, you're right. But there are simulations like that. They just hide the control points and make the tactors lie. Didn't you go on Demon Playground with me once? You don't even have any limbs on that. You're just neural ganglia strapped into a rocket sled. Jesus, Gardner, you're not listening. I'm not just guessing. I went offline. My parents pulled my jack out. And it hurt, Orlando. It hurt like nothing I've ever felt. Like they'd pulled my spine out with it. Like someone was sticking hot needles into my eyes. Like I can't even tell you. And it didn't stop. I couldn't do anything but scream and scream.
Frederick stopped, shuddering, and could not speak again for a few moments.
It didn't stop until my parents put the jack back in. I couldn't even talk to them. And bang, I was back here.
Orlando shook his head.
Are you sure it wasn't just, I don't know, a really bad migraine or something?
Fredericks made a noise of angry disgust.
You don't know what you're talking about. And it happened again. Jesus, didn't you hear me screaming? They must have taken me to a hospital or something, because the next time it came out there were all these people standing around. I could hardly see, it hurt so bad. But the pain was even worse than before. The hospital gave me a shot, I think. And I don't remember much after that for a while. But here I am again. They must have had to plug me back in.
Fredericks leaned forward and gripped Orlando's arm, his voice raggedly desperate.
So you tell me, Mr. Golden City, what the hell kind of simulation acts like that?
What have you gotten us into, Gardner?
The hours of daylight and night that followed were the longest Orlando had ever spent. The fever returned in full strength. He lay thrashing in a shelter Fredericks had built from palm fronds, freezing and burning by turns. He thought his subconscious must be acting out Frederick's story of escape and forced return, because at one point he heard his mother speaking to him, very clearly. She was telling him about something that had happened in the security estate, the community, as she called it, and what the other neighbors thought about it. She was prattling, he realized, in that very particular way she did when she was scared to death, and for a moment he wondered if he was dreaming at all. He could actually see her, very faintly, as though she stood behind a gauze curtain, her face leaning in so close that it seemed distorted. He had certainly seen her that way often enough to make it a feature of a dream. She was saying something about what they were going to do when he got better. The desperation in her tone, the doubt behind the words, convinced him that, dream or not, he should treat it as real. He tried to make himself speak, to bridge the impossible distance between them. Mired in whatever it was, hallucination or incomprehensible separation, he could barely force his throat to operate. How could he explain? And what could she do? Beazel, he tried to tell her. Bring Beazel. Bring Beazel. She fell away from him then, and whether it was only another phantasm of his febrile sleep or an actual moment of contact with his real life, it was gone.
You're dreaming about that stupid bug,
Fredericks growled, his own voice clumsy with sleep. Bug, dreaming about a bug. As he slid back into the dark waters of his illness, he remembered something he had read once about a butterfly dreaming it was an emperor, wondering if it were an emperor dreaming he was a butterfly, or something like that.
So which is real?
He wondered groggily.
Which side of the line is the real one? A crippled, shriveled, dying kid in some hospital bed? Or a made-up barbarian looking for an imaginary city? Or what if someone completely different is dreaming both of them?
All the children at school were talking about the house that burned down. It gave Christabel a funny feeling. Ophelia Weiner told her that a bunch of people got killed, which made her feel so sick she couldn't eat her lunch. Her teacher sent her home.
No wonder you're feeling bad, honey,
her mother said, a hand on Christabel's forehead, checking for a temperature.
Up all night like that, and then having to listen to all those kids telling stories about people dying.
She turned to Christabel's father, who was on his way to the den.
She's such a sensitive child, I swear.
Daddy only grunted.
No one got killed, honey,
her mother assured her.
Only one house burned, and I don't think there was anyone in it.
As her mother went off to wave her some soup, Christabel wandered into the den where her father was talking with his friend, Captain Parkins. Her father told her to go outside and play, as if she hadn't been sent home from school sick. She sat down in the hall to play with her Prince Pick-a-Pick doll. Daddy seemed very grumbly. She wondered why he and Captain Parkins weren't at their office, and wondered if it had anything to do with the big bad secret thing that had happened last night. Would he find out what she had done? If he did, she would probably get punished forever. She pulled Prince Pick-a-Pick out of the nest of pillows she had made him. The outer doll tended to scramble toward dark, shadowy places, and scooted closer to the door of the den. She put her ear against the crack to see if she could hear anything. Christabel had never done that before. She felt like she was in a cartoon show.
A real goddamn mess, Daddy's friend was saying. After all this time, though, who'd have guessed?
Yeah, said her father, and that's one of the biggest questions, isn't it? Why now? Why not 15 years ago when we moved him the last time? I just don't get it, Ron. You didn't turn him down for one of his weird requisitions, did you? Piss him off? Christabel didn't understand all the words, but she was pretty sure they were talking about what had happened at Mr. Sellers' house, all right. She had heard her daddy on the phone in the morning before she went to school, talking about the explosion and fire.
Gotta give the bastard credit, though.
Captain Parkins laughed, but it was an angry laugh.
I don't know how he managed to pull it all off, but he damn near fooled us.
Christabel's hand tightened on Prince Pick-a-Pick. The doll let out a warning squeak.
If the car had just burned a little longer. Captain Parkins went on. We wouldn't have been able to tell the difference between the stuff he left on the seat and a genuine cremated Sellers. Ash, fat, organic wastes. He must have measured it out with a teaspoon to get the proportions right. Clever little bastard.
We would have found the holes in the fences, said Christabel's daddy.
Yeah, but later rather than sooner. He might have had an extra 24 hours head start.
Christabel heard her father get up. For a second she was scared, but then she heard him begin to walk back and forth like he did when he was on the phone.
Maybe. But shit, Ron. That still doesn't explain how he got away from the base in the time he had. He was in a wheelchair, for God's sake. MPs are checking everything. Could be someone just felt sorry for him and gave him a lift. Or he might have just rolled down the hill and he's hiding out in that squatter town. Nobody who knows anything will keep their mouths shut once we finish rousting the place. Someone will come forward.
Unless he had a confederate. Someone who helped him get out of the area entirely.
Where would he find someone like that? Inside the base? That's a court-martial offense, Mike. And he doesn't know anyone off the base. We monitor all his household contacts, outgoing calls. He doesn't even access the net. Everything else is harmless. We watched him real close. A chess-by-mail arrangement with some retired guy in Australia. Yes, we checked it out carefully. A few catalog requests and magazine subscriptions. Things like that.
Well, I still don't believe he could have pulled it off without any outside assistance. Someone must have helped him. And when I find out who it is, well, that person's going to wish he was never born. Something was making a thumping noise. Christabel looked up. Prince Pick-a-Pick had crawled away under the hall table, and now the otter doll was bumping over and over against the table leg. The vase was going to fall over any second, and her daddy would hear that for sure and come out really angry. As she scrambled after the runaway otter, eyes wide and heart beating fast, her mother came around the corner and almost tripped over her. Christabel shrieked.
"Mike, I wish you'd take some time to talk with your daughter," her mother called through the closed door of the den. "Tell her that everything's all right. This poor little girl is a nervous wreck."
Christabel had her soup in bed. In the middle of the night, Christabel woke up scared. Mr. Sellers had told her to put on the new storybook sunglasses after school, but she hadn't done it. She had forgotten because she came home early. She slid down onto the floor as quietly as she could and climbed under the bed where she had hid them. She had taken the old pair with her to school and thrown them into the trash door outside the classroom during recess, just like Mr. Sellers had told her to. Being under the bed was like being in the Cave of the Winds in Otterland. For a moment, she wondered if there really was any place like that, but since there weren't any otters left that didn't live in zoos, her daddy had told her that, there probably wasn't a Cave of the Winds anymore. The sunglasses weren't blinking or anything. She put them on, but there was no writing, which made her even more scared. Had something happened to Mr. Sellers down there under the ground when the house blew up? Maybe he was hurt and lost down in those tunnels. Her finger touched the switch. The sunglasses still did not turn on. But just as she was thinking they might be broken, someone said, "Christabel?" very quiet in her ear. She jumped and banged her head against the underside of the bed. When she dared, she took off the sunglasses and stuck her head out. But even with the dark all over, she could tell that there was no one in the room. She put the glasses back on.
"Christabel,"
the voice said again,
"is that you?"
It was Mr. Sellers, she suddenly realized, talking to her through the sunglasses.
"Yes, it's me,"
she whispered. Suddenly she could see him, sitting in his chair. Light was shining on only one half of his runny-looking face, so he looked even more scary than usual. But she was happy to see that he wasn't hurt or dead.
"I'm sorry I didn't put them on before," she began.
"Hush, don't fret. Everything is all right. Now, from here on, when you want to talk to me, you must put the glasses on and say the word. Oh, let me see."
He frowned.
"Why don't you pick a word, little Christabel? Any word you want, but not one that people say very often."
She thought hard.
"What was the name of that little man in the story?"
she whispered.
"The name the girl was supposed to guess."
Mr. Sellers slowly began to smile.
Rumpelstiltskin? That's very good, Christabel. Very good. Say it yourself, so I can code it in. There. And you can use it to call me every day after school. Maybe on your way home when you're by yourself. I have some very difficult things to do now, Christabel. Maybe the most important things I've ever done.
Are you going to blow more things up?
Goodness, I hope not. Were you very frightened? I heard the noise. You did an excellent job, my dear. You are a very, very brave girl. And you would make a wonderful revolutionary.
He smiled another of his raggedy smiles.
No, nothing else is going to blow up, but I'll still need your help from time to time. A lot of people are going to be looking for me.
I know. My daddy was talking about you with Captain Parkins.
She told him what she could remember.
Well, I have no complaints then, said Mr. Sellers. And you, young lady, should go back to sleep. Call me tomorrow. Remember, just put on the glasses and say Rumpelstiltskin.
When the funny old man was gone, Christabel took off the storybook sunglasses and crawled out from under the bed. Now that she knew Mr. Sellers was okay, she suddenly felt very sleepy. She was just climbing back under the covers when she saw the face peering in through her window.
It was a face, Mommy! I saw it! Right there!
Her mother pulled her close and rubbed her head. Mommy smelled of lotion, like she always did at night.
I think it was probably just a bad dream, baby. Your daddy checked, and there's no one outside.
Christabel shook her head and buried her face against her mother's chest. Even though the curtains were drawn, she didn't want to look at the window anymore.
Maybe you'd better come and sleep with us.
Christabel's mother sighed.
Poor little thing. That house burning down last night really frightened you, didn't it? Well, don't worry, honey. It's nothing to do with you, and it's all over now.
The technicians wanted to make notes for the cleanup. Dredd was mildly irritated, since he had last-minute details to attend to, and this was not the most convenient time to be forced out of the observation center. But he approved of their thoroughness. He took a small cigar from the humidor and went out onto the top-floor balcony overlooking the bay. The Bena y Bena technical crew had already broken down his office in the city. Now that the project had moved into the final phase, there was no longer a need for it. And once the operation was complete, there would be no time to go back and tie up loose ends. So the crew had emptied it completely, which included sandblasting the top level off all permanent surfaces, repainting and replacing the carpets. Now the same men and women were busily examining the beach house, which served as observation center. By the time Dredd and his team were in the water heading for the target, the cleaning crew, like white-clad scavenger beetles, would be pulling the two-story house to pieces and destroying all clues as to who had inhabited it these past 3 days. He really didn't mind at all being forced out to the balcony on a fine tropical night, he decided. He had not allowed himself a moment's recreation since the stewardess, and he had been working very, very hard. Still, it was hard to forget business with the target literally in sight. The lights of the Isla de Santuario were barely visible across the expanse of black water, but the island's various security devices, the drone submarines, mini-sats, and hardened sites defended by armed guards, were not visible at all. Yet each and every one had to be dealt with. Still, barring the kind of major miscalculation that Dredd had never yet made, confident, cocky, lazy, dead, he reminded himself. Barring miscalculation or criminally negligent intelligence gathering, all were known and prepared for. He only awaited the solution of a few minor loose ends, and then the actual arrival of the rest of the team, slated in 4 hours. Dredd had deliberately kept them away until this moment. There was nothing the actual site offered that could not be learned and mastered in simulation, and there was no sense doing anything that might alert the target. The cleanup crew were the one group that did not prepare in VR, but their van was parked in plain sight in the driveway, bearing the name of a well-known local carpet retailer. And of course the Baynas had arranged for someone on their own payroll to be answering the phones at the carpet warehouse all week,
in case someone on the island should spot the van and do that little extra conscientious bit. So now, with all the leisurely pleasure of an actual householder enjoying the prospect of handsome new floor coverings, Dredd turned up his internal music, then leaned back in a broadly striped canvas chair, lit his cigar, and put his feet up on the balcony railing. He had smoked barely half the cigar, and was idly watching the island's perimeter spotlights reflecting on the water like amber stars, when a much smaller light began to blink at the corner of his vision. Dredd cursed silently. The soaring Monteverdi madrigal, his favorite music when he was playing a contemplative scene,